In our study about a shadow of good things to come, we've been looking at how God foretold and foreshadowed in the Old Testament what He was going to do in Jesus Christ and in the church in the New. And last week, we looked at something that I call making known the end from the beginning. We actually were reading from Isaiah, where God, speaking through Isaiah, says that who else but God is able to make known the end from the beginning. One of the characteristics of true prophecy, as opposed to just what soothsayers and those who often say what they think others want them to say, is that it actually comes true. It doesn't come true because the one speaking it makes it come true. It comes true because they were told beforehand what the future holds. That's prophecy. That's real biblical prophecy. And it's unique in all the world. You might look at all sorts of other cultures, religions, and even people who claim to be prophets, who claim to be able to foretell or predict the future. And even the very best of them, if such a thing exists, are abysmal in their track record, but not so biblical prophecy. Of course, the critics have had their things to say about that, and we've tried to address some of those. Essentially, the critic has to ignore the facts and then try to misrepresent what's really going on in order to attack biblical prophecy. And last week, we looked at the fact that prophecy relies upon both the veracity or trustworthiness of both God and Jesus. Because God said ahead of time in the Old Testament that He was foretelling the coming of someone. And then in the New Testament, we see Jesus saying that the Old Testament predicted His coming. And if those are accurate records of what was said, then prophecy ends up becoming a test of the trustworthiness, the believability, the credibility of both God and of Jesus. But now what we want to do this morning is to continue that thought by just looking at 10 examples from the Old Testament that the New Testament says pointed to Jesus. And so I raise the question as I have it up here. I'm going to try this out again on Sunday morning for us of projecting something up on the screen. Is it by chance or was it really by promise? Is it just accidental? Is it just coincidental that Jesus fit what the Old Testament said He would be like? I work right next door to a 7-Eleven store. Those who know me well know that it's no secret that I drink a big gulp or two every day. 7-Eleven special. So I'm over there in the morning, pretty soon after I get to work. Then I'm over there in the afternoon, often for a refill. But I would say that 9 times out of 10, when I'm there standing in line to pay for my big gulp, there is one or more people in front of me paying for lottery tickets. Now, they may be buying into the big one, which what happens on Wednesday nights and Saturday nights, I think. I don't follow that. I don't participate in it. But it seems like it's twice a week, and that's where you pick out, 6 out of the 52 or 54 possible numbers it might be. And they have the machine that prints out the ticket and hands it to you. But then there's all the scratch-offs and other things they have under the counter they sell as well. And I've been going over there long enough, 10 years now, that I pretty much see the same people week after week, often day after day, spending their $1 to $10 to $20 on various forms of the lottery tickets. And what are they doing? It's called a game of chance. We lived in Las Vegas for 2 years. We can tell you something about games of chance. But we didn't participate in them. There were lots of people there who participated in the gaming industry from the standpoint of spending money, little or much, on the chance that they'll get the right numbers, the right roll of the dice, the right set of cards, or whatever it might be to win money, big money. Chance works on the theory that certain things eventually will come up. You know, if you take 54 numbers and put them in a bucket, numbered on balls, just like they do, and you just reach in and pull them out, and that's essentially what they do to pick those numbers twice a week. And then you at home ahead of time were supposed to try to guess what those 6 numbers were going to be they're going to pull out. Well, they tell somewhere in very small print what the odds are you'll pick the same 6 numbers they do at any given time. It's in the millions, tens of millions to one that you will pick the same 6 numbers they do. You see, the lottery doesn't lose money for the state of Texas. It makes money. They give away far less money than they take in. I haven't seen the numbers recently, but when we lived in California, which had the lottery a long time before Texas, their percentage on average out there was for each $10 million people spend on lottery tickets, the state gives out $3 million in winnings. That's not very good odds. overall. So that means $7 million were spent that never comes back to anybody. Of course, the big controversy got to be out there is that $3 million, that 30%, that are $3 million of what was left of that $7 million that wasn't given back out, was supposed to then go to education. And a big controversy eventually over that, because as soon as they started getting the money in, the legislators stopped budgeting as much money for education, just counting on the lottery to pay for education. And then when, after a while, people finally figured out they weren't winning enough on the lottery to justify spending that much money on it, the income from the lottery went down, but the legislators had already taken all the money out of the budget to pay for education. And I think similar things are somewhat happening here in Texas, whether we realize it yet or not. But it's all on games of chance. What are the odds? And in a sense, we want to talk about that a little bit this morning. In the passage that Don read to us out of Acts 13, Paul is standing up in front of some Jewish people who believed in Old Testament prophecy. And he tells them that what God had prophesied through the prophets has now come to pass in Jesus. And he doesn't talk like that just happened by chance. He's letting them know that was by God's plan, by God's promise, that it would happen that way. And these predictions or these prophecies that we're talking about were not so generic that just anything would fit them. I mentioned this right at the very end of our lesson last week. And that is, first of all, the prophecies we read about in the Bible about Jesus, many of them are very specific. They mention something that would only fit a very few or even one person. It's not like a prophecy that might say, well, he'll have brown eyes. Well, you know, what percentage of the Jewish population has brown eyes and always will? The majority. Even if it said he had blue eyes, that would still fit a minority. But the prophecy often was so very specific that it would only fit either just a few or in some cases only one. It was very specific. It was very unique. That is, it would be easily identifiable from the standpoint that you just wouldn't expect that in someone. It would distinguish them. It would be overt. It would be open where others could easily examine it. You know, it wouldn't say that he's going to have a leaky heart valve. You know, most people would never be able to check that out. Something that's internal or hidden. But it would be always overt. It would be easy for anyone to check out. And it would be the kind of thing that because people knew it was specific, unique, and overt, they could anticipate it. They could look forward to it and know when it happened. And so now quickly we want to look together at 10 specific, unique, recognizable, anticipated Old Testament prophecies. 10 prophecies from the Old Testament that the Jews themselves acknowledged before Jesus came and before the New Testament was written. That they acknowledged that they were talking about someone they call the coming Messiah. And they were looking for those 10 things in that person. Now they were looking for a lot more than those 10 things, but we're just going to look at 10 this morning and see how they quickly narrowed down who it could possibly be. And these things were written before the New Testament because we have copies of the Old Testament that even critical, unbelieving scholars admit were written before the New Testament was written. And so it's not like these things were written after the events. These were before. Let's take the first one here. It says in the book of Micah, and in chapter 5, verse 2, that someone is coming who is going to be born in the city of Bethlehem, that he will be the one they're looking for. Micah. It says, Micah 5, we'll start in verse 1. It says, "Marshal your troops, O city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod." Micah is talking about tough times going on in his country right then. Because of the wickedness of their king and the wickedness of their nation, God was punishing them as a nation, and their king was going to be defeated in war. He's going to be humiliated by his enemies. But this causes Micah, then to make a prediction about someone else who's coming who's going to be just the opposite of that. They see their present king. They know he's not their savior, their deliverer, but someone is coming who will be. And then it says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephratah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." So the promise is that out of Bethlehem will come someone who will be a ruler for God. And it says of this person who's going to be coming from Bethlehem, that He is from of old, that He is from antiquity, or even some translation will say from the beginning of time. Well, what are the odds of that? Well, the verse itself, first of all, acknowledges some of the odds of that. It says that Bethlehem, out of all the many different villages and towns that existed throughout the Jewish nation, whether you take just Judah or the combined Judah-Israel nation, Bethlehem was pretty small. There were hundreds of others the same size, hundreds who were larger than them. Of course, their largest city by far was Jerusalem. There were other large cities like Samaria, and later, by get down to New Testament times, cities like Caesarea and Capernaum. There were large cities for their day, and thousands of smaller villages and towns. And Bethlehem was just one of those small ones. So right away, we hear the prophet and the prophecy saying that whoever's coming is going to have to come out of just one small town out of all the many. That eliminates a lot of people right away, doesn't it? It would eliminate good people, potential candidates for this, because they have to come out of just one small town. Now, it turns out that small town is also the town from which their most famous beloved king had come, and that would be David, who had been born several hundred years before Micah wrote this. So he's not talking about somebody from the past, but he's looking to the future, to someone who's going to come out of the same town David did. Then we see in the New Testament that they recognize this, because in Matthew's account of the birth and life of Jesus, he tells us something that must have been common knowledge in their day, that about the time that Jesus was born, strangers showed up at Herod's court, Herod the king. And these men who were powerful and influential from whatever nations they had come from off to the east came to Herod and said, "We have come to see the king who's been born." Well, Herod was old. He was going to die in just another couple of years from his age and infirmities. He had had no children in his family for a long time. So who are they talking about? He wants to know that as well. And he calls in the chief priests, the wise men of his nation, the Jewish leaders, and he asks them, "Where is the king that was prophesied in the Old Testament? Where was he supposed to be born at?" He obviously is paranoid. And they said, "Well, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem, of course. Bethlehem." So it won't be long before Herod will actually be sending troops down to the city of Bethlehem. City being used somewhat kindly. It's estimated probably in New Testament times Bethlehem had a population of somewhere between 300 and 600 people. Not a very large place, not very many people to choose from. But he sends troops down there, and they go house to house and find every male child who had been born in the last 2 years, and he has them killed. He doesn't want there to be another king. He wants his son to be king. He's trying to stop what God has promised would happen. But the promise is that it'd be born in Bethlehem. But more than that, there were plenty of people who lived in Bethlehem, of the few who lived there, who were could not claim as an ancestor David. But the promise in the Scriptures was that this person born in Bethlehem was also going to be a descendant by direct genealogy of their ancient King David. The Jewish people were free to live just about where they wished throughout their land. And so people of several different tribes, and even within the tribe of Judah that David was from, numbers of different families were in that tribe. And many of those people probably had some relatives, at least, that lived in Bethlehem. Might be a first cousin or a great uncle or whatever. So how many of the people who lived in Bethlehem were actually direct descendants of David? We don't know. But it was far less than the total number of people that lived there. But the promise from the Scriptures was that the one who's going to be born is going to be a descendant of David. We read that, for example, in Isaiah's prophecy, written 700 years beforehand. It says, Isaiah 11:1, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit." And the Jews had been looking at this promise of Isaiah for hundreds of years and believed that it was talking about the coming Messiah. And so it's got to be someone born in Bethlehem, and that person born in Bethlehem needs to be a descendant directly of David. Jeremiah, who lived about 600 years before Jesus was born, writes the same thing in Jeremiah chapter 23. And in verse 5, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land." So again, the promise that whoever this coming person is will be a direct descendant of David. You ever puzzled why Matthew, the book of Matthew, begins with what's called a genealogy? how he starts right in by saying, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and on until we get right down to verse 16, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. Matthew, being a proper Jew, knew that most people would be interested in the genealogy of the father. Now, Joseph wasn't Jesus' biological father. We'll talk about that next. But from a Jewish standpoint, legally, inheritance passes on from father to son, even if it's not biological. So Matthew presents us with the legal genealogy of Jesus and shows that he was a direct descendant of David. But he's not the only one. If we turn over to Luke, we find another genealogy. And at first it disturbs people because it's not identical to the one we find in Matthew. But there's a good reason for that. Luke tells us in Luke chapter 3 that he is tracing a little different genealogy. Most scholars suggest to us that he's actually giving us the genealogy of Mary. I don't know if that is accurate or not. We don't have the information at this point to do that. But what we do know is that Luke, just like Matthew, establishes for us that the person he's talking about, Jesus, is a direct descendant of David. And so we have, again, a narrowing down of who this person can be and the qualifications he has to meet. He has to be born in Bethlehem. He needs to be a direct descendant of the ancient great King David. And number three, something that pretty much eliminates all but one person, or if you don't believe in miracles or the possibility of miracles, would eliminate everyone altogether. And that is the promise from the prophets in the Old Testament that he was going to be born of a virgin, that there would be no human father. In Isaiah 7, when we read that passage back there, we find, first of all, and I grant this freely, that as Isaiah first speaks this prophecy, he is speaking to King Ahaz of Judah. And he's telling Ahaz about something that's going to happen in his day. But the fascinating thing about it is that the Jews later looked back on this and said, that never really happened in Ahaz's day. So he must have been actually talking about something still in the future. So wonderful, so amazing, that it would only happen once in the history of the entire world. And that is that a virgin would give birth to a child. A woman would conceive, then have a child, without there being any human father at all. And that's how the Jews interpreted that. You see, when we say this, this isn't something that Christians later look back in the Old Testament and said, oh, that must have been talking about Jesus. No, the Jews had been believing that for hundreds of years before Jesus came. And so there was a prophecy of that. And Matthew, again, is the one who quotes that passage out of Isaiah and says that's what happened with Jesus. And both he and Luke give us the details of what happened with Mary. The appearance of an angel, the promise that she would be with child even though she was not married. We're even told about the man she's engaged to, Joseph, and how that he knows that it's not his child. He has no reason to believe that she's been unfaithful to him and been immoral with someone else except for the fact she's pregnant. I mean, everybody knows if a woman is expecting a child, then there's got to be a father somewhere. And yet both Mary and an angel assures him that there is no human father, the same as had been assured to Mary herself. So, born in Bethlehem, a descendant of David, born of a virgin. We might even point out that Luke is careful to explain to us how the family came to be down there just at the moment Jesus was born, because all the indication is that both Mary and Joseph made their home 70 miles away in a town called Nazareth. But suddenly it came into the mind of the emperor of the Roman Empire that it was time to clean up the tax rolls and get a more accurate accounting of who all his subjects were throughout the world. And so from the eastern end to the western end, from the northern end to the southern end of the Roman Empire, he sent out an imperial decree that all people must go back to their hometown and re-register on the tax rolls. And the reason you had to go back to your hometown is because different countries in the Roman Empire were taxed differently based on what their relationship to the Roman Empire was. And so if you happen to be Jewish and had been born in Nazareth, say, but now you were living in Greece, in Athens, they didn't want you to go register in Athens because people in Athens paid a different tax. May that sound fair to us, but it's true. They paid a different tax than people from Nazareth did. So you had to go back to your hometown and register on the tax rolls there. And then that, from those rolls that were made, all those records went back to Rome, and then the royal accountants figured out how much money Galilee, where Nazareth was, since we're using that as an example, is supposed to send to Rome each year in taxes. And they did the same thing for Judah, where Bethlehem was. Well, Joseph is from Bethlehem, even though he's living in Nazareth. So he has to take his family down, because they're going to be taxed too, you know. Now that he's going to be married, the tax is going to be based both on him and Mary. And if the child is born, while they're there, on the child too. So he goes down to Bethlehem, and while they're there, enrolling on the tax rolls, Jesus is born. And yet the prediction that's behind all of that was one made 700 years before. To be born of a virgin, going to be born in Bethlehem. God brought those two things together by having the emperor of the Roman Empire declare that everybody had to go home and be enrolled on the tax rolls. And so they were. What are the chances? Not just that the child himself has got to be born in Bethlehem, but because of what God just did, his legal father had to be born in Bethlehem too. So he'd go back there just at the right time to be born. Fourth prediction that narrows it down pretty quickly. Yes, there were people in Bethlehem. Yes, in Bethlehem there were descendants of David. Can't speak to the idea of whether or not there were any of them born of a virgin. I suspect none of them were. But the prediction also in the Old Testament was that this person to be born in Bethlehem, a descendant of David, born of a virgin, was going to be called the Son of God. Now, the Jews called themselves children of God, but to be called the Son of God was a very different thing. The Jews in general, and we even see that during the life of Jesus, if someone claimed to be the Son of God, they took that as sacrilege. They took that as someone claiming what no one could claim except the Messiah himself. And since they didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah, then they believed he was guilty of blasphemy. Now, if they had believed he was the Messiah, they wouldn't have thought that of him. But they didn't believe he was the Messiah, and so when he claimed he was the Son of God, they thought he was guilty of blasphemy. But the passage, one of several actually, where the promise is made ahead of time is in the second Psalm, which is attributed to David himself. The one who's going to be the ancestor of this Messiah, in whose hometown this Messiah is going to be born. It's David himself in the Psalm, second Psalm, who says this. The whole Psalm is about this coming one. But in particular, it says in verses 6 and 7, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Now at first, David might say, well, that's what God said to me. He made me king. He put me on Mount Zion. That's where I established my capital city. I was the first great king of this nation of his people. And so he could say, God said to me that he's my father and I am his son. Yet David never claimed that about himself. It's David who says, someone in the future that's going to be true of. Someone in the future, one of my descendants that God promised would sit on the throne after me, God's going to actually call him God's own son. And so we find that said of Jesus. Wish we had the time to, you know, look at these passages. But I know if you read them, you'd recognize them. Matthew's account, Luke's account, even John at this point records how when John the Baptizer was baptizing Jesus, that John the Baptizer heard the voice from heaven that said, this is my son. He's going to be called Son of God. That narrows down the possibilities. Not everyone in Bethlehem, a descendant of David, ever called himself Son of God or was called that by others. And then we move away from his birth to his life and ministry. And another promise that's made in the Old Testament, this time by Moses himself. This puts us back 1,200, 1,300 years before Jesus came. We find that Moses, in his old age, he's about to die. He's making his last address to the people of God before he's going to go up on that mountain, and God will watch over him until he dies, and then God will send an angel to bury him. As he speaks to his people, in Deuteronomy 18 and 18, he says that God spoke to him and said, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among my brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. So Moses himself says, God will someday raise up another prophet like me. He will speak God's words. He will give God's law. And we know that Moses went on after his death to be the most highly respected and even revered person in Jewish history, even above David. For he was God's spokesman, God's prophet, God's lawgiver, God's leader. He was actually the father of their nation, having led them out of Egypt and through the wilderness and to the promised land. But it's Moses himself who says, someone else will come. He will be like me. When we read all the rest of the Old Testament, we never find a single reference that the Jews ever referred to anyone as being like Moses. As much as they respected a lot of people, and there were dozens of prophets we have the names of, and hundreds more that are mentioned in the Old Testament we don't have the names of that were prophets of God, not a one of them are ever referred to as being a prophet like Moses. Now, when we get down to the New Testament, we see a little something interesting happen. If we don't even go yet to the Matthew 21 passage, we find out that when John the Baptizer first starts preaching, some people come to John in John chapter 1 and says, are you the prophet? What are they asking him? They're asking him, are you the prophet that Moses was talking about? They already knew he was a prophet. They said, are you the prophet? He said, no. Then who are you? He says, I am the one that Malachi spoke about in Malachi 3:1, which we'll look at in a moment, who's supposed to go ahead of the one who's to come and announce his coming. That's who I am. What was John himself saying? No, he wasn't the prophet Moses was talking about, but he was the one to go right ahead of that prophet. And it's only a few days later that as he sees Jesus walking by, he says, look, there he goes. So of all the people born in Judea, in Israel, we've already narrowed it down to somebody born in Bethlehem, somebody who's a descendant of David, somebody who has to be born of a virgin, someone that people refer to as being the Son of God, a very unique and controversial title, but more than that, someone who would be just like Moses. And it says in Matthew chapter 5 that Jesus went up on the side of a mountain and sat down as his disciples gathered around him and the crowds below him, and he began to teach them, saying, Moses gave the law on Sinai. Jesus gave his law beginning on what we call the Sermon on the Mount. He was a leader, a lawgiver, a prophet, a miracle worker. He created a new nation, a spiritual nation of people. He himself said in Matthew chapter 21 that Moses was talking about him. Now Moses, as great as he was, didn't often serve in the role of a prophet in predicting the coming Messiah. In fact, practically speaking, the only prophecy Moses ever gave of the coming of Messiah is this one. And so when Jesus says in Matthew 21, Moses was talking about me, there's not much chance Jesus was talking about any other prophecy Moses made except this one, because that's the only one Moses ever made about a coming Messiah, a coming one. Jesus said he was talking about me. People question whether he's the one. Over in Acts chapter 3, Peter, standing in the temple area after the church has begun in chapter 2. In chapter 3, Peter quotes that passage by Moses and says, Moses was talking about Jesus Christ, who's now come and who you have rejected, talking to the Jews. So it needs to be someone who is so unique and so special that people would say he's a prophet like Moses, which since Moses had lived, we have no record that ever referred to anyone that way until Jesus came. He was going to be full of the Spirit. By the Spirit, they meant God's Spirit, the Holy Spirit. In Isaiah 11:1, we've already read. The very next verse, it says of the same one that verse 1 is talking about, that he will be filled with the Spirit. Hear it again, Isaiah 11:1-2. First of all, he's going to be a descendant of David. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. And then he went right on to say, and this descendant of Jesse or David will be full of the Spirit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He's going to be full of the Spirit. And Isaiah picked up on that several times, as you see in the references there, Isaiah 42:1 and Isaiah 60:1. All of those speaking about this person coming is going to have the Spirit of God on him. At Jesus' baptism, not only did God speak out of heaven, but he gave a visible manifestation or a demonstration of his Spirit coming down and resting on Jesus as he was about to begin his ministry. And John, the baptizer himself, will say, I didn't know for sure he was the one until I saw the Spirit come down on him. And I tell you what, John the Baptizer was closer than anybody to that event, because he was right there next to Jesus, having only just baptized him, when not only did the voice speak out of heaven, but the demonstration of the Spirit came in the form of the dove. And John said, this is how I know he is the one. I saw the Spirit come down on him. For John, that was the most telling evidence. John already knew Jesus had been born in Bethlehem. He already knew it's his cousin. He already knew he's a direct descendant of David. But it's when he saw the Spirit come on him, to him, that was the evidence that finally convinced him Jesus was the one, full of the Spirit, preceded by an announcer, a herald, a forerunner, who is John himself. We've already talked about that passage in Malachi, but there's also one in Isaiah that says that one will come ahead of this promised one, and he will prepare the way. He'll make the hilly road flat. He will make the rough road smooth. He's going to prepare the way for the one right behind him. Luke says John was that person. Matthew says John was that person. John himself says, I am that person. He was the one coming just ahead of the Messiah. And it also promises in the Scriptures that the Messiah, when he comes, will do miracles. More than just do miracles, but he will have a ministry of miracles that will be manifest or demonstrated by many miracles he will do. Isaiah 35, there's 10 verses there. I don't want to read them all on such short notice here. But it does say of the one when he comes that he'll strengthen feeble hands. He will help fearful hearts. He will cause the eyes of the blind to be opened. The ears of the deaf will be unstopped. The lame will leap like a deer. The tongue of the dumb will shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness. The burning sand will become a pool and the thirsty ground bubbling springs. What's it saying? That when he comes, he will have the power to change everything. Or maybe the passage we recognize better that also says he'll be filled with the Spirit, as we had in the last reference, Isaiah 61 and 1, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and provide for those who grieve in Zion. And it goes on and on about what he's going to do. Jesus stands up in the synagogue in his hometown and says, after reading this passage, Luke 4, he reads that passage out of Isaiah 61 and says, today this passage is fulfilled in your hearing. What was he saying? That scripture is talking about me. That's what he was saying. A ministry of miracles. And no one could deny that. That's probably one of the most outstanding overt things about Jesus' work was the miracles he did. After he raised Lazarus from the dead, even the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem said, what can we do? Everybody's going to be a follower of his if this keeps up. And so they started plotting not only to kill Jesus, but to kill Lazarus too, to kill him all over again, let him die a second time. They needed to shut that man's mouth up. He's convincing too many people that Jesus was doing miracles just by being alive. His was a ministry of miracles, but he was also a stone of stumbling. That was another prophecy. In the Psalms and in Isaiah as well, it says that the religious leaders, the Jewish leaders, would stumble over him. While in many ways there was going to be a smooth highway made for people to come and follow him on, for the Jewish leaders, he was going to be a rock they were going to trip and fall over. They couldn't get past it. And that was prophesied 3 different times in the Old Testament, and how true it was. They could not, would not, accept that he was the Messiah to come, even though their own investigations had to show that he fit all the criteria that the prophets had foretold. Paul, even when he was preaching the gospel, writing to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians, says that the gospel he preached was a stumbling block to the Jews and sounded like foolishness to the Greeks. It says, because the Greeks are always looking for something that looks like wisdom to them, and the Jews are always looking for one more sign, one more miracle to prove it was really him. And so they stumble over him. And then the 10th one, and this one we're not even going to be specific about. When we talk about the death and resurrection of Jesus, it was foretold in the Old Testament. There's at least 29 different prophecies in the Old Testament that talk about something to do with the trial and death of Jesus. And then even more that talk about his resurrection on top of those 29. Evidence. I wish we had time to read Isaiah 53 one more time. For it talks in the most complete form about his trial and his death, and then at the end, his coming to life again. So what are the odds that one person would fit all these? For men like Peter, Luke, John, and John the Baptist, the other apostles and disciples, and thousands and tens of thousands of other people who lived in that first century, who had a better chance even than we do to go check out the evidence for themselves, the odds are too great for it to be anyone else than Jesus. And the odds are too great for it not to be him. The evidence was too great because there was no one else that all of those things ever fit. There still has been no one else in the 2,000 years since then that these things could fit. So if it fits anyone at all, it fits Jesus, Son of Mary, born in Bethlehem, only him. No other example in history. What does this tell us about who he was then? If he fits all the prophecies from the Old Testament, he's the only one who ever has, then is he the one the Old Testament was talking about? Surely he was. What chance is people taking today? What gamble are they taking if they refuse to believe in him then?